This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Thank you and welcome to the Bundeswehr Military Museum in Dresden, where we and our partners, the British Council, continue our exploration of the legacy of the First World War. In such a graceful Baroque city, brutally flattened in the Second World War, this museum, run by the German army, shows an extraordinarily even-handed approach to the morality of war. There's a large display of a firebomb Dresden pavement upstairs. The incendiary impacts are clearly on view, but it is matched by two ruins from other cities which German bombers laid waste. There was no such even-handedness in apportioning blame for the First World War. The Treaty of Versailles was unequivocal. The Allied and associated governments affirm, and Germany accepts, the responsibility of Germany and her allies for causing all the loss and damage of the war. Germans have shouldered that burden of blame in different ways at different moments. So who here in this audience tonight was taught that Germany was to blame for the beginning of the First World War as well as the Second?
I was told that. At school, I was told that Germany was to blame mainly for the outbreak of the war.
Is it in the textbooks?
In the textbooks by teachers, in historic films.
And do you mind me asking, how old are you?
I'm 25.
Okay. So maybe I'll find a representative from a different generation.
Aha. Yes, I have learned in this way in my school time, in the first school time, I remember.
When were you at school?
From 1953 to 67.
So already you were taught that, actually, then, before the 1968 generation.
In the ground school, in the primary school, I don't think so. It was in the gymnasium at about 1960.
Thank you very much. That is interesting, because I hadn't expected the idea of guilt to be taught in schools so soon after the Second World War. Well, tonight we'll be exploring whether Germany was really responsible for starting Der Erste Weltkrieg, the First World War. It was a gruesome conflict that saw the first use of gas, zeppelins, the tank, flamethrowers, biplanes and wide-scale submarine warfare. Here to debate the machinery and morality of war are two German historians who have written extensively on the First World War. Zernke Neitschel gained his PhD from the University of Mainz and also taught at the universities of Bern and Saarbrücken. He is currently Professor of History at the LSE. Annika Mombauer is Senior Lecturer in Modern European History at the Open University, UK. She studied history at the Westfälische Wilhelms-Universität in Münster. Please join me in giving them a warm welcome to the stage. Zernke, can we start with the origins of the war? The Archduke was assassinated in Sarajevo on the 28th of June, and so began the period of extreme international tension known as the July Crisis. Germany came into the war on the 1st of August, but it wasn't the first country to mobilise. So what was the order of events?
Well, there's a lot of orders to events after the 28th of June. I mean, we have the blanco check from the German 6th of July to the Austrian-Hungarian government. We have the ultimatum to the 5th of July. And
Zonka, for the audience who might not have heard of the blank check, this famous message sent by the Germans to the Austro-Hungarians, what was the blank check?
The question after the assassination of the Archduke from the Austrian-Hungarian perspective was, what will the Germans do? The government in Vienna was already clear, we want to have a local war against Serbia. This is the only way how to solve the so-called Serbian problem. But the problem with attacking Serbia was there might be Russia behind Serbia and we might have a great war. And we need the Germany as an ally. So there was a treaty between the two, but it was a bit of an unsecureness in this relationship. So the emperor sent an ambassador to Berlin and asked him, what will Germany do? And the German reaction from the Kaiser and the German chancellor was, we will back you whatever you do. So the blank check on the 5th and the 6th of July 1914. In the end, this was then very decisive. So the Austrian-Hungarians were able to concentrate on Serbia. They prepared an ultimatum, which was delivered on the 23rd of July, and Serbia had to answer that ultimatum 2 days later, within 48 hours. They did so on the 25th of July. They accepted almost all points, but not all points. This was the reason why the Austrian-Hungarian government broke off diplomatic relations. This was the threshold, if you want. So
the tipping point.
The tipping point. And then it was very, very quick, and we have the preparations for mobilizations in Russia. And then the Austrians shelled Belgrade on the 28th of July. Serbia mobilized.
So you're saying Russia mobilizes first?
That's definitely true, yeah.
So, Annika, does that mean that Germany's able to present their actions as defensive? Is that the way the Kaiser might have sold it to his people?
Yes, that's exactly how the war is sold to the people. And as you put it, that is how Germany can pretend, in a sense, that Russia starts the war. Because even though technically it's true that Russia does mobilize first, a decision had actually already been taken in Berlin that they would need to mobilize whether or not Russia mobilized first because of the time constraints that were weighing down on Germany because of the so-called Schlieffen Plan. Germany would have implemented the Schlieffen Plan, would have invaded Belgium exactly as it did whether or not Russia had mobilized because that had been decided.
Putting the other side of it, perhaps, though, would you argue that perhaps the Germans had a right to feel insecure? After all, they were encircled by great power alliances.
In a way, I think this is true because we sometimes discuss the war guilt question or the outbreak of the First World War, we see it from nowadays and with our moral judgments, and we just can't look at the July crisis itself, I would argue. So there's a reason why the Germans, the Austro-Hungarians, and even the Russians and all others acted how they acted. And from the German perspective, at the time, there was a reason for perceiving the international relations, well, in the end, we are encircled. And you find this in the documents, and even with diplomats and others, saying, you know, there's no way for us to gain anything. They don't want to have us in the club of world powers. We belong to that club in view of our economics, but they don't want this. And there is a reason for that, to seeing this.
So
that
to way. Paint a picture of Germany at that moment, this is a newly created great state of 70 million people undergoing its economic miracle. I came across an extraordinary statistic. By 1914, the German economy generated and consumed 20% more electricity than Britain, France, and Italy combined. So you get a strong sense that this is a kind of powerful nation that expects some recognition. So I wonder how far German public opinion favoured war as a golden opportunity for Germany to punch its weight.
I mean, it's a difficult question because there's nothing like Germany. I mean, there's so many debates. Of course, we have warmongers, we have the general staff preparing a war, but we have a lot of pacifists. We have even in July peace demonstrations. So there are a lot of opinions in Germany. But you could argue that, I would at least argue that with the international crisis ongoing, from the First Moroccan Crisis in 1905 to the Balkan Wars, there was at least in a portion of the elites the feeling, well, we are not in the position prestige-wise where we belong to, and there wasn't rising acceptance of a war.
Annika, the German leadership seems to me extraordinarily militaristic. So yes, there might be many shades of public opinion, but if military opinion is predominating, isn't that a huge factor in the escalation of war?
I think it is a factor. I mean, Germany at the time is a very militaristic state. It is a country in which, not least due to the politics which were made under Kaiser Wilhelm II, the military were able to dominate politics, and that went right through society, this reverence for all things military. That doesn't mean, though, coming back to your earlier point, that this feeling of encirclement that you described, that wasn't something that was shared also in other countries.
Yeah, their perception was, when you mentioned that, we are economic-wise, we are quite big, we are the second largest economy in the world, and we deserve to be a part of the club of great power, of world powers. And if they have colonial empires, we also want to have a colonial empire. And this idea, we want to be equal. The Germany want to come in, and others, in a way, to put it very, very short, don't want to let Germany in. And who's to blame? That's the question now.
Annika, Fritz Fischer, a famous German historian who in the early 1960s made the link between World War I and World War II, claimed there was a tradition of German aggressiveness which made Germany responsible for both wars. Isn't the burden of your work that Germany did want a war?
Yes, absolutely. There is plenty of evidence to suggest that in 1914, the military and political leadership in Germany was keen to use the opportunity that the July crisis presented it with. Everything came together, and this was a golden opportunity as far as the warmongers in Berlin and also in Vienna were concerned. They're clear, and they do say so, if we support the Austrians in their war against Serbia, Russia will almost certainly come in. This will turn into a European war. They talk about a world war. They talk about a war that will destroy the civilization of Europe. And yet they are prepared to carry on with their belligerent foreign policy, to support the Austrians until it's too late, to say no to any negotiation suggestions that come out of London. So I do think that the German government carries a large share of the blame.
Zunke, so Germany started two world wars. Do you agree?
No.
Why not?
How much time do I have to explain this? No, I mean, I think the central person is Bethmann Hollweg, the German Chancellor, and there was a calculation. But to me, it's a reason for that. So it doesn't come from the moon that they sit around the table and say, now we are going to fight a war. So I think it's very, very different from Hitler as a situation. I do think that it's a bit too simple to say, you know, it's the Germans and the Austro-Hungaries, and we only concentrate on the ultimatum. There was a reason for that, and also that France, Russia, and even Great Britain accepted to say, you know, if Austro-Hungary goes to attack Serbia, this is a reason for us to wage war and to fight. So in the end, you could see that there's not very little to do with Serbia, but all great powers were in the moment where I said, you know, the problem is Germany, the problem is Russia, the problem is France, and we're going to solve our problems by a war. And this was not very different in Russia and not very different to France.
I'm going to have to stop you there for a moment, because yeah. I think it's time for the audience to give us their views on where are you landing on both sides of the debate. So, was Germany responsible for both wars?
World War II.
World War II, but not one?
No, neither one nor two.
Oh!
Hitler, nobody likes him, but Germany would have received his war even if there had no Hitler been.
There's a question on my right.
Hello, my name is Werner Jahn. I came from here, from Dresden, and I want to notice my grandfather was in this war 3 years as a medicine helper, and I'm sure nobody can blame him for this war, for the beginning for this war.
So no one can blame your grandfather individually for the beginning of the First World War. Yeah.
I mean, of course,
would you
we
agree? Yes.
I mean, we would agree. Even in the discussion about the outbreak of the war, we are talking about, I mean, like Holger Havik put it, about 50 men in the capitals, possibly a bit more if you talk to the elites, but nobody's blaming the ordinary soldiers.
Annika?
Yes, absolutely. And nobody had a choice, of course. Your grandfather would not have had a choice. There were lots of people who did not believe in war before the end of July 1914, and they are taken in by the propaganda and by the lies that are deliberately told. And so you don't get the big demonstrations and the strikes that the government feared would happen, because everybody is convinced that they're fighting a just war. So your grandfather, I'm sure, would have thought he was fighting a just war, just like everybody in France, Britain, Russia, and all around the world.
Moving on through time, now, after the war, came the Paris Conference and the Treaty of Versailles. Le Boche payera, the Boche must pay, had been a French rallying cry through the war and after. And now Germany was being made to pay, literally, and they were forced into signing the infamous war guilt clause I read out to you earlier. Well, this can't have gone down well here at home in Germany.
Well, no, this clearly didn't go down very well at all. And you've got to, again, put yourself in the shoes of the people of 1919. There are many in Germany who think that the war wasn't actually lost, for a start. You know, you were stabbed in the back. You returned with your troops undefeated at the front. So you haven't lost. And you really knew that you hadn't started the war, because that's what you were told right from the end of July 1914 onwards. You were told this by the Kaiser, by Bethmann Hollweg, by propaganda throughout the war. Germans had fought a defensive war. That is what everybody believed.
Zünke, it must have been particularly hard for Germany to accept all of the guilt for the damage that the war had caused, given that Germany had undergone a grueling blockade. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
This was, I think, the only subject every German could agree to in the Weimar Republic, which was a hugely divided society. We are not to blame for the war. And yes, the blockade, I think, played a very, very important role for the German self-perception. I mean, it's very interesting to see that immediately after the war...
It's a British blockade,
The British
it?
Blockade of German trade, yeah, and we all know what it means. So it was the cut off the German overseas trade. And the perception of that was, of course, this was a violation of international law. Britain hasn't...
But to be concrete, does it mean that food is literally not getting into Germany? Or people
yes,
are starving?
I mean, it's a bit... Yes, they're starving, but it's a bit more complicated, unfortunately, because we know that about 500,000, 600,000, we don't know the exact figures, people somehow starved or got ill because of food shortage. This was, of course, due to the blockade, but also because of the German chaos in distributing the food which was available. So I think the whole perception of Britain as the main enemy, which started right after the war in August and September 1914, if you read the letters and the perception of the Germans, or the most Germans, the main enemy was so
of
Britain.
Of course, people felt betrayed by Britain, that the German government felt betrayed, because right until the end of July and very early in August 1914, there was this hope, almost hope against hope, that Britain would somehow stay neutral. And so there was the hope that war against Britain at least could be avoided.
Well, and they're all interrelated, those monarchies, aren't they? I mean, so they're all, most of them seem to be the grandchildren of Victoria.
Yeah.
King George and the Kaiser are cousins.
Yeah, but then if you think, you know, just because you're related doesn't necessarily mean you get on.
I'm sure
lots of us can think of examples.
We've been discussing moral blame for the First World War and its origins. Later, we'll be moving on to gas, tanks, submarines, and the methods used in war. But who would like to ask a question about what we've been discussing so far?
Thank you very much. My name is Niels Kasselmann, and I'm from Berlin.
Great.
You have already been talking about this a little bit, but I was just wondering if you could elaborate it a little bit more, as if how the German government and the military were connected and were influencing each other in parts of the war getting started.
Annika, well, what you get in Wilhelmine Germany, obviously you have the Kaiser, who's the supreme warlord and who makes all important appointments, and he can appoint and dismiss as he wishes. So that will influence the type of person that he surrounds himself with, and it will also influence the types of decisions that that person might make. So if you look, for example, at the chief of the general staff, Helmut von Moltke, from 1906 to 1914, he's not necessarily there because he's the best man for the job. He's partly there because the Kaiser likes him and because he has a good name, because his more famous uncle was, of course, a very successful military leader, but is a personal choice by the Kaiser. So he surrounds himself with people who he thinks will do what he would like them to do. And so they are, in a sense, people who will say, yes, Your Majesty. And so Moltke is in a particular bind as he realizes that we only have the Schlieffen Plan by 1914. By 1916-17, that plan won't work anymore because the Russians will by then have increased their armies to such an extent and have sped up how quickly they will be able to mobilize that we can no longer implement the Schlieffen Plan. Could he really go to the Kaiser and say, Your Majesty, I'm really sorry, I know I've got the good name and everything, but I have no good plan. From now on, your foreign policy better be less belligerent and less aggressive because I cannot follow it up with a military means. So you get a system where it's not possible, like France, where politicians are then able to say to the military, hang on a minute, we can't just go and invade Belgium. We signed a treaty to say we would uphold its neutrality. But in Germany, the civilian leaders, the chancellor and the state secretary for foreign affairs, they are not in a position to question what the military do because they, just like the military, depend on the Kaiser for their position.
Next question.
Okay, that's me. I'm original from the Netherlands, but living for a time in Dresden. The Netherlands was neutral in the First World War. You talked about relationships. It has to do with the relationship between the Royal House of the Netherlands with the Royal Houses of Germany and the hosting of Kaiser Wilhelm I or II, I don't know which Kaiser it was.
Hosting in
the Netherlands or had refugee in the Netherlands.
Are we saying is that why they didn't invade the Netherlands?
No, I think the question is about Wilhelm II being allowed to flee to the Netherlands in 1918, in November. Is that what you're referring to? Because, yes, you're right that the Dutch Queen allows Kaiser Wilhelm II asylum, if you like, in the Netherlands. And, of course, he stays there in House Dorn until his death.
Zunke, what do you think?
I mean, the Netherlands were quite important for Germany and because, I mean, originally the Schlieffen Plan was also to attack the Netherlands, as the Germans did in the Second World War. But it was Moltke the Younger left it deliberately out because he wanted to have access to the world market. So the Netherlands were seen or were perceived somehow as a lifeline. So yeah, we can wage even an aggressive war. We can even have a British blockade. But we have, due to a neutral shipping, we will have the access to the world market. This even worked until 1916. So you have American meat coming through Rotterdam on the Rhine on the German plates, if you want. But then the British closed that gap and made the blockade total. So the Netherlands had in the German war planning, in the perception of a future war, in the economics, in a very important role. It was deliberately not attacked.
Well, some fascinating questions there and great responses. Thank you. I'm Amanda Vickery, and you're listening to the BBC World Service. This is the war that changed the world. We are in Dresden, Germany, and now the second in our series of essays selected by the British Council. Please welcome an artist and photographer whose latest project brings military killing into sharp focus. Herlinda Kerbel.
When we remember certain events, they are almost always connected with images. Images are the condensed emotions that don't allow us to forget. Which images of the First World War do we carry in our minds? We remember photos from the start of the war on which soldiers hastened to the train station, happy and laughing to be part of it, still feeling like heroes. But that was to change. At the end of the war, photos show dead soldiers in the trenches, sprawled out, bent, or lying mutilated in the mud. And we also see the pictures of men returning, of tired, emaciated, or wounded bodies and numbed, empty faces. They were targets, and they survived. But 10 million soldiers and 6 million civilians were killed in that war. And my project targets, I look at the present day. I visited 30 countries to document the appearance of the targets with which soldiers today are conditioned to shoot. Or as a trainer said, they are supposed to learn to hit, not shoot. Another said, it sounds cool, but you have to learn to kill automatically in order to function. How is he represented today, the enemy that soldiers are later expected to kill? Is he an abstract figure? Does he have a face? And if so, what kind? Has the image of the enemy changed? Yes, it has changed. The person who accompanied me to an American shooting range explained, my target used to be a green figure of Ivan with a red star on the helmet. The enemy was the Soviet Union. The red star has gone. New targets have appeared, figures with oriental-looking clothing and dark skin, a new enemy. But who is the enemy? The enemy is always the other one. I never felt guilty about killing people who deserve to die. In my eyes, they deserve to die because they are the enemy. I'm trained to think that way. Whichever side a soldier is on, in America, in China, in Russia, or in Israel, he always believes he is on the right side. And he has to believe this in order to be willing to die. I accepted to kill, and being killed is part of the job, a soldier told me. Humans have a natural inhibition about killing. A brutal method of removing inhibitions was practiced in the First World War already, as shown by a photo from the US Army from 1917, killing with a bayonet. A soldier of the Royal Fusiliers described it as follows. This great big sack was hung up on a string, and we had to assume it was a person. You had to pull it in. You were told how to twist it and pull it out again. That was a part of the training when you really began to think that you have got to beat a man in front of you. The methods are perfected increasingly, directed reducing inhibition. In Ukraine and Iraq, we are now seeing once again how fragile peace is. Conflicts in these countries during the First World War have after effects to this day. Having taken photographs in so many crisis regions, I have the impression that for us in Europe, peace is almost for granted. We should be more aware of our good fortune in living in peace for more than half of a century. Many armies that were enemies in the First World War now train together. Diversity has turned into unity for securing peace in troubled regions. One soldier on an operation said, there will always be war as long as there is man. History supports his view. Since Cain and Abel, there have been violence and war in all cultures for many reasons. Is there a hope for a better future without war? Politicians must focus on the effort of talking to the others and negotiating. Political questions cannot be decided by war, as has been demonstrated not only in the First World War. On the contrary, war often creates new and more difficult problems. Thank you.
Helinda, come and join us. Thank you. That was so spine-tingling and poignant. Zonka, Helinda talked there about how images really represent condensed emotions. And one of the strongest images that I have of the First World War is that of the Zeppelin, mm-hmm. with all its sleek immensity and modernity.
Very, very British.
Well, I think it must have been absolutely terrifying when it nosed its way out of the clouds.
To Britain.
To Britain, to Britain indeed. But isn't it your argument that these sorts of new machines are not that significant in the conduct of warfare?
Yeah, I mean, they are very important for the images, they're very important for the propaganda war, because the Germans used to bomb on a larger scale civilian population first. I don't have to count now single bombs on a larger scale. It was the Germans who started air attacks on British towns in January 1915. But it was the impact on that was more for the images of the bad Germans, some things. The really impact in view of the huge losses on the Western Front or on other fronts was really very, very small. There were about 1,600 British civilians being killed by German air attacks, and 800 German civilians were attacked by Allied air attacks. But what is 1,600 for? I mean, hundreds of thousands of Brits were killed, or 10 million people, and millions of civilians were killed.
Annika, but the first air attack from a Zeppelin in the First World War was not on Britain, it was on Liège on the 6th of August, where 9 civilians die. Now, I'm sitting here in Dresden, you know, the idea that, you know, from 9 civilians on the 6th of August, you know, it's actually not a very long time before we get to, obviously, February 1945 and latest estimates, 25,000 people at least dead. And, of course, on the 6th of August, again, 1945, you get to Hiroshima. So, it's the start of something really, really hideous, where you're making civilians targets in a way that I think they weren't before. But it was supposed to terrify the enemy, and of course it did.
Shock and awe.
Yes.
So 25,000 dead in this city.
In one night.
But coming back, Zunke, to this issue of Germany's industrial innovation and how, you know, what a powerful modernising economy Germany had in 1914. What impact does technology have and industry on the nature of this war?
I mean,
surely it plays a decisive role. Or are you arguing not?
No, I think it's more the industry than the technology. I mean, if you compare the First World War with the Second, for example, if you could argue the Second was a high-tech war with radar and atomic bomb and other things, really, and also a lot of resources went into the air war, because it was very, very expensive in the Second World War to build an aircraft, a night fighter, and so on. In the First World War, it was rather cheap. So it was, you could build, a machine gun, artillery piece quite quickly. You can even build a fighter quite quickly in comparison to later periods. So I think it was the industries, the industrial powers going to war and have mass mobilization. That was the point.
I'd like to bring in Helinda now, though. Do you think this technological change, how have you seen that reflected in the work you've done on the creation of targets? We hear so much about drones and smart bombs. There's always a human target in the end.
You know, of course, we have now drones, and it's easy to kill somebody from the desk, you know. But that is, I think it's another part. It's a new part. In the First and Second World War, we had a real clear side. That was one side, and that was the other side. And you know who is the enemy. But nowadays, it's mostly the asymmetric war, and that's totally different, you know, like in Afghanistan, you never knew exactly who is the enemy or where is the enemy. The enemy could be the shepherd. The shepherd could be also, but a normal shepherd, but it could also be the enemy with a bomb, you know.
Although the First World War, after all, was created by a kind of terrorist cell.
And we have to think, I mean, there was also this new war. I mean, I think the new wars we are talking about, the asymmetrische Kriege, they are not new, of course. And you have this in the First World War, the Toplica uprise in Serbia, 20,000 civilians were killed by Bulgarian, Austro-Hungarian, German forces in the Second World War as well. So, of course, we don't have the big battles anymore. Mm-hmm. But this asymmetric war was always there, I would argue, in the whole 19th century in Spain against Napoleon, but also in the First World
War. It was there, but the main battles was always fought.
That's true, yeah.
That's the main thing in the First and Second World War. There were clearly two sides, and the main soldiers were fought and died in really two sides, you know.
And 40% even in the First World War of the casualties were civilians.
So, okay, poison gas is a horrendous weapon of war, and it was later banned in Geneva. How did the Germans come to develop weapons-grade gas?
There was a debate, even from those these guys who developed the poison gas. Fritz Haber, his wife, shot herself after he developed that mustard gas. But it was very much the situation. Germany was fighting on two fronts, and the German perception was, it's not a normal war, it's about dead or alive. It's about, we must win this war. If we don't win this war, Germany will be crushed, defeated, it's the end of Germany. And there was this argument, which we even find nowadays, it's about military necessity. So if you have a weapon, you use it. The Brits had the possibility to blockade Germany, of course they did it. The Germans had, because of their chemical industry, the possibility, or there might be, we might have a small advantage, come on, we use it. And even with the submarine warfare, it was a long debate, but in the end, they end up with an unrestricted warfare against neutral shipping, civilians, 28,000 were killed.
Annika, related to that, it was sometimes argued that the 19th century philosopher of war, Clausewitz, had a great effect on German tactics. His famous line, "War is merely the continuation of politics by other means," shows a clarity which I know some find refreshing, but others find amoral. Do you think there was a kind of mechanistic cool-headedness about war which led Germans into doing things that other countries would balk at?
No, I don't think Germans were in that sense very different. I mean, Clausewitz was well regarded outside of Germany, just as he was within Germany. And at that time, war was regarded as a legitimate, though regrettable, means of continuing what you wanted to do anyway. I think it's important to remember that when we look back on this war, we know of its horrors. The people who willingly risked it did not know what was coming. I mean, you go into the war with, you know, the beginnings of 20th century technology, but with a 19th century attitude to warfare at the beginning, and then you have this sort of learning curve. So when Helinda mentioned the bayonets, I mean, this is it. You go you start this war on horseback with your bayonet. And already, you know, there is this modern technology emerging, but clearly people have not made the connection yet between that technology and what that actually means for how you fight the war.
What does the audience think? Do you agree with our historians that the German military mindset was really no different from that of the other European powers? What would you say, sir? I'm called on somebody in military uniform.
I agree with Zönke when he said, what is possible, you will use. And when you have an invention and when you have the better weapon, you will use it. And that's it.
That is a terrifying judgment.
Yeah, it is, of course.
Give us your name and where you're from, your name and your rank and your serial number.
My name is Colonel Rock, and I'm the director of the Military Zoo Museum here in Dresden.
Who else shall I call upon? Oh.
I'm Nadia Mazawi, and I'm from Dresden. I think that war became more and more
anonymous
with the technology. I think it's perhaps easier to kill when you don't fight face to face. and you don't see the suffering. Mm.
Well, so many more died from shelling than died actually from a bullet wound. Now, any other reactions to our historians? Yes, sir.
The gas war, I picked up in several dictionaries that very clever Britain started the gas war during the Boeren Wars in Africa. But the Germans are silly enough to accept the model and build it greater.
Who else?
I think it's a problem of democratic consciences, maybe. So Germany, especially in the First World War, didn't have a democratic tradition. They were a monarchy. So I think it's true. They had the technology, they used it. But in modern times, maybe this democratic consciousness as or the parliament, as a counterpoint, you can say, or the people can say, yes, we have the technology, but we don't use it because we are a democracy. And they didn't have this choice because they didn't have this mindset.
Annika?
Well, you know, having said all I said about Clausewitz and how all the military, you know, thought in the same way, nonetheless, it is because of the German system that we already discussed that in Germany the military are able to use those weapons first, are able to use these new techniques first and use them to such devastating effect. So in that sense, it does matter to me who does something first. It does matter to me who declares war first, who starts shelling first, who starts bombing civilians first. Those kinds of things, I think, in the end, do matter, even though, of course, once the war is well on the way and it is this total and this devastating war, atrocities are committed everywhere. It's not just Germans. But I think there is something unique about the political system that exists within Wilhelmine Germany at the time that allows these weapons to be used first, that allows this war to be wanted more than in other countries.
Can I respond?
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, this is a very typical British view, of course. The Brits always...
From a German?
Yeah, from a German. She was living in Britain quite a while. So, no, but I mean, we have this debate. I mean, the end of the debate is, and it's driven by British historians in a way, it's we Brits are better in the end. And it's the Germans, they are...
The baddies.
I mean, their arc sin is 1871. It's the German Empire, and it's all rubbish, and it's all not a democracy, so far and so forth. So, and this is a clear vision, and then sometimes, not Annika, but sometimes even then a direct line to Auschwitz and these things. But I mean, I'm very...
Surely the drift, actually, amongst most historians now, is to decenter the role of Germany anyway and say it's a multi-centered war.
Yeah, but also, I mean, even if you say, well, who killed the first civilians? It's the Russians in Eastern Prussia. But even it's in the matter of days, so forth. So I think it's inherited in the armies. The Germans said, oh, because of the British blockade, we have to bomb or we can bomb. But we can. The Brits had the blockade. They were violated international law. And if you see British history, don't mention the Berber and other things, I just can't see that the British army, for example, and other armies are really that much different.
Annika?
If you look at, for example, the bombing of the northeastern English towns of Scarborough and Whitby, for no real military benefit, it was not clear what the benefit of this was, but again, it is something that is ordered by the military, and there is nobody who can object to this. And again, it is the Germans, and a lot of the atrocities that happen, not all of them by any means, but you know, the first bombing of civilians in this way, the first shelling of British towns, the first use of submarines in that way, those we have to put down, chalk up on Germany's account.
I'm glad at least we've drawn out the differences in the debate, but Helinda, you've grown up very much in the shadow of the Second World War and the Holocaust and Germany's involvement in both. It is an extraordinary burden for a nation to carry, and I do think Germany still engages with its past in enlightened and questioning ways, to which this museum is testament. But here in this city, which also carries the pathos of its own partial annihilation in war in a single night, is it time to shrug off responsibility for the First World War? What do you think?
You know, I wouldn't say the Germans, that I'm always careful, but of course the young, the really young generation, like one of the Jews I made all the portraits of the Second World War, that, you know, the young generation has not the guilt, but she has the responsibility, the young generation, that won't be happened again. But on the other hand, wherever you go, all the young generation, when from the outside you can't throw away the guilt of the two world wars, you know, of the two, first and second one. Yeah, and you always will be confronted wherever you go. From the outside, Germany will always be reminded on this guilt or what they have done. And the interesting thing is now when the Germans won the football game against Brazil, you know, a friend of mine sent me an article of the Japanese newspaper. The Germans did the blitzkrieg again. Oh. You know what I mean? Whatever the Germans do, you will be confronted. You can't escape your history.
Well, it's possibly only a joke.
Well, indeed, but jokes are not without point. This is The War That Changed the World from the BBC World Service. We've been discussing the methods and morality of warfare in the First World War. And we have been exploring the impact of the war through German eyes. And we've heard an essay on modern warfare and the conceptualizing of targets from the artist and photographer, Herlinda Kerbel. Now, who has a question about anything we've been discussing tonight? Now, I know some of you have got questions stored up. There's one here in the front row.
My name is Richard Weber. I'm from Leipzig. And I would like to ask, why do we ask the guilt question today? Why is it necessary to ask the guilt question?
Is the guilt question still necessary? Annika?
Yeah, I think it doesn't help to make the two world wars one guilt question. I think we need to separate that out. And I think it's not about guilt as much as about responsibility when we talk about the First World War. And if we put ourselves in the minds of the people of 1914 and their so-called unspoken assumptions, to speak with James Joel, then we're looking at people who are very different to us. So I don't think we should necessarily even judge them. I don't think we really can. They did feel encircled. They did feel threatened. They did think social Darwinism was an actual concept that affected the way nations could sink or swim, and obviously they wanted not to sink. So we need to be mindful of how people ticked at the time, but nonetheless, within that, decisions were made which brought this war about. This war happened for a reason. This war was not an accident. It didn't just happen because somebody, you know, forgot to close a window and there was a bit of a draft. Somebody made a decision, or some people, as you say, perhaps as few as 50 or fewer people, made decisions, and there are different degrees of responsibility. And I think that's important to bring out, and that's something that the recent debate, which has started again on the origins of the war, has brought out very nicely.
We have time for one more question. Yeah.
I'm Jan-Paul Hase from Dresden, and I would like to know which role did the religions play in the First World War? And how did the nations explain that my enemy has the same religion like me?
Good question.
That is a good question, yes.
I think the First World War was for the first time that Christian armies fought against each other and didn't perceive themselves on the same stage. You had this in the war against the Turks in the 17th century, of course, but nowadays in the perception in Britain and Germany was, well, no, they are the evil. And even if they are Christians, they are the arch evil and we have to defeat them. And massively supported by the church, by the priests going to the front. So in a way, this was part of the propaganda war. And in the way the church helped to wage that war and to give reason for that war.
But there's no such thing as a kind of single church. I mean, and it is the case that France and Britain have been to war many times, both Christian countries, but what was important for the British always was that they were fighting a Catholic.
Against the nasty
A French. Catholic enemy. Yeah. And actually the difference here is that the British Protestants are fighting German Protestants.
Yeah, and it's about Christians fighting against each other, not perceived, even in the British and against the French, they don't like each other, and so the Catholics and Protestants are front of force, but then they were on the same level in the end. An English knight and a French knight were on the same level. And that's changing in the First World War for the first time, that Christians one religion, if you want, perceive themselves as not on the same level, and you have to wage almost a total war against your enemy. And this we only have that in the wars against the Turks.
Well, that has been a really enlightening debate for me, and I've especially enjoyed engaging with this wonderful audience here in the Bundeswehr Military Museum in Dresden. Now, please, on behalf of the BBC World Service and our partners, the British Council, and my producer, Charlie Taylor, could you join me in thanking our panel of Zunke Neitzel, Annika Mombauer, and Herlinda Kerbel.
From objects to emotions, to instincts and compulsions, what we're thinking and what we say. Why do we do the things we do?
The opportunity to really see the world in a way that hadn't been possible before.
Every week on The Why Factor, we try to make sense of the world around us by taking a fresh look at the everyday.
It's quite incredible.
That's The Why Factor, online at bbcworldservice.com/whyfactor.
I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and for BBC Radio 4, this is History's Secret Heroes, a new series of rarely heard tales from World War II.
They had no idea that she was Britain's top female codebreaker.
We'll hear of daring risk-takers.
What she was offering to do was to ski in over the high Carpathian Mountains.
Of course it was dangerous, but danger was his friend.
Subscribe to History's Secret Heroes wherever you get your podcasts.